Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is February 17th. First announcement on the House Bill 2341, which modifies the definition of marijuana for purposes of controlled substance laws. We are not going to hear today. There's parties have seen some problems with that, so they're going to work that out and bring it back, try to get it fixed before we hear it. And on the last bill on today's schedule, House Bill 2318, will not be worked today because there's been an unexpected fiscal came up on that, so we have to take another look at that. So first item on the agenda today, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2400.
House Bill 2400 requires police departments to institute a policy as to whether officers may wear their uniforms in public when not working. We have received the reports back, and there's no fiscal or revenue impact, so it's ready to be worked.
Thank you. Brian DeLashman, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brian DeLashman. I'm here representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations, which is a council of approximately 5,000 police officers, other public safety officers, including corrections officers, parole and probation officers, and 911 communicators in the state of Oregon. This is a pretty simple bill, just a couple of lines. You may be aware of it. I've talked to many of you. But the issue here is consistency and application of whether or not a public safety officer's uniform is the property of the jurisdiction and how it can be used in certain circumstances. Let me start with a little illustration. How many of you in your office or someplace have a picture similar to this? Or we'll soon have a picture the result of the sheriffs having their day down here. This good-looking fellow over here, obviously, is John Goodman, representative in the House. This picture was taken some time ago. The sheriffs were down here several weeks ago, had a sheriff's day. Obviously, I have no bone of contention with the sheriffs themselves coming into the Capitol building in uniform. However, our issue is if we were to have a police officer's day in the Capitol building, rank-and-file police officers would not be able to come in the Capitol building in their uniform because their jurisdictions, although they allow this and allow chiefs in many cases to come in the building in uniform, they do not allow line staff to come in the building on behalf of my association or other associations representing public safety officers. So that's our issue. This bill in itself does not say that they can or can't. What it says is each jurisdiction will establish a policy that's consistent on the application and use of uniforms for off-duty circumstances. If you also will notice, and I was very keenly aware of it on the sheriff's day in the building, not only were the sheriffs in uniform, but some of my members were in uniform. Now, again, if that was a police officer's or a deputy sheriff's day, they would not be in uniform in this building. But because it was the sheriff's day, the sheriffs requested the CERT folks and the search and rescue folks from a couple of jurisdictions who are my members to come and be in uniform in the Capitol building. So it was fine to use the uniform on the sheriff's day of my line staff. And in that case, it isn't the property of the jurisdiction, and that's all fine and good. But again, if I have a day like that, we can't have those kinds of days. And so they have to come either in a suit and tie or an association logoed polo, which you will see around here. Let me bring up a couple other situations. I mean, obviously, a number of you, all of you run for elected office. I have several associations that do endorsements for candidates for elected office. And upon getting an endorsement from one of my public safety clients, I often get a request, can I get a picture of one of your members that I can use in running for office? And my response is, I will check with the local jurisdiction to see whether or not we can have that picture taken. But the likelihood of having that picture taken in uniform is basically zero. Turn that around, however, when it's a local bond election and it's the city or a special district is trying to pass a bond, a local bond, and they want the support of the public and they want the support visible of public safety. They, of course, allow pictures to be taken of firefighters standing in front of their fire trucks and police officers in front of their vehicles, and they use that that illustration to promote their bond elections. The same thing has occurred historically, and I've been in this building for 32 years now, when it's a statewide measure, and I will use one particular person's name in somewhat in vain, but historically, when there was some Bill Sizemore anti-tax, anti-government measures that were going around the state that would have helped, would have hurt not only the state of Oregon, but also local governments and their ability to function in public safety and other aspects of government, the local jurisdictions were happy to allow my police officers to be in uniform at a press conference. But if it is something that they don't haven't bought off on as a jurisdiction, then in fact they would not allow that involvement. So again, when is a uniform the property of the jurisdiction? We'd like each jurisdiction to have their own policy that's clear and it's consistent from the top to the bottom. Again, this is not about, you know, although I've mentioned the sheriffs or the chiefs, I think the message is getting around a little bit that this is a bone of contention with my folks, and you'll see some of the chiefs and sheriffs a little more sensitive and not coming in the building, but that's the issue. The one additional thing that I will mention is during this last election cycle, there was both a Democrat and a Republican running for the legislature that are public safety officers. And this issue in itself of whether or not that officer could in fact be seen in their uniform in any kind of literature became an issue. Well, let me tell you that a public safety officer's uniform not only identifies them, but public safety officers in themselves are much like military. That is the essence of who they are. And their ability to be shown as, this is who I am, this is what I do, and the uniform itself, which is a major component of that, is very important to them. And so, obviously, this is wrapped up in this as well. If a local jurisdiction where that officer is running says, no, none of us will do that, then that's fine. But we've got situations now where not only do I get requests for candidates wanting to have their pictures taken with these folks, but also we have candidates who are running, and the jurisdictions do not have a policy that is uniformly applied. And with that, I'll answer any questions. Thank you.
Representative Stigler.
Mr. DeLashmet, currently, I just want to be really clear. Currently, there is no policy in state statute regarding this issue, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Stigler, no, there is no statewide policy. And again, this, in essence, this statute doesn't establish a state policy. Right. It just directs the locals to have a policy.
Right. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
And that was going to be my next question. All this does is direct an entity to actually have a policy so that there's no guesswork one way or the other?
Mr. Chair, Representative Stigler, yes, exactly. And just one additional clarification. Someone asked me as well, does this mean that an officer can, in fact, go to court when it's not a case they're involved in? One example was an officer is cited for speeding themselves, and it's an off-duty, so they show up in uniform. I think the local policy would probably cover those kinds of situations, but what we're really talking about here is just ballot measures, elections, the ability to represent your association, your police association, or firefighter association, or a corrections association in the Capitol building and other venues. Thank you.
In the Multnomah County race, there was the former chief of Gresham, and there was some question about her uniform, and they said she could, if I read it correctly in the paper, you can't wear your own uniform unless you can find one. And she wouldn't be someone who you could just go to the store and find off the rack. And she claimed, well, she got their shirt from Value Village, and they allowed her to wear that for an ad. I don't know.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that brings up kind of an interesting little sideline. Anyone in the public can go to a costume outfitter and get what would be considered basically a phony police officer's uniform. Actors, when they're in commercials, do that. We have, in some cases, when there's been a ballot measure that we wanted to get our word out on, actually had to have actual officers who had their own uniforms go and find a costume uniform in order to be able to be in a commercial. And that seems a little bit odd. But the circumstance you're talking about is, again, that was one of the cases in which the chief was running for office, and one of the public safety officers in that jurisdiction or area was also running for office, and how that was applied and whether or not that policy was consistent from the top to the bottom.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair? Yes, Representative Krieger.
A couple of questions. Line 6 says, all members of each department must be subject to the department policy. So you'd be saying that an elected sheriff would have to have the same right or not right to use the uniform, or the chief of police, the same right as the field people?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, that's what it means.
Okay, well, I would disagree with that. And I'm kind of come from that background. The superintendent represents the department in the state of Oregon, officially, politically, socially, every way there is. He's different than my job was. I just look at that part different. The other thing was, with a policy that just was adopted that says it'll be up to the sheriff to make a case by case determination. That's a policy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, let me answer your first statement and respond to that first. If, in fact, the sheriff or the chief is acting in their official capacity as the chief or the sheriff, let's say they're coming to the Capitol building on behalf of Lane County or City of Eugene or City of Roseburg, we have absolutely no problem with them representing that jurisdiction as the chief or the sheriff in uniform. What we have a problem with is a chief or sheriff's day in which they're coming on behalf of their association rather than as a representative of their jurisdiction, and they're in uniform when my folks do not have the same right. So that's the first issue. I've lost your second point, so if you could...
Well, you've talked so long, I forgot it.
Then I did my job, Representative.
Mr. Chair, it's the same question I was going to ask. As I read your language, it would not preclude a department from adopting a policy that says it's discretionary. That's the policy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct. And the policy could be, for purposes of representing the city at events or the jurisdiction, the county, that's permissible if it's representing that entity. However, if it's association business, that's a no. Or it could say the individual officer cannot use their uniform for their own personal business or any of their own issues, but if they're there representing their association that they're a member of on behalf of that association, then it's uniform, chiefs, sheriffs, and line staff. So the policy is whatever they want to make it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you show us that picture again, and could you tell us who is in that picture?
Well, hopefully you can see it, but it's Representative Schaffler with the former sheriff from Multnomah County.
I just wanted to let the record reflect that it's not John Goodman, who you said earlier.
I think that was that he shaved on Saturday. More like John Goodman than he did. This picture, he also has a picture of himself with the current sheriff from Clackamas County. He did, however, loan this one to me for the
I'll hold up, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to be really clear here, because as I read this, a policy under this provision, even though you have this statement, all members of each department must be subject to that department's policy, the policy conceivably could have different standards or different configurations for different members of the of that department. So it wouldn't necessarily, my reading of this language, have to be the same for the chief as it is for the line officers. Isn't, I mean,
Mr. Chair,
unless there's something here that I'm missing.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we believe that that's the case as well.
Okay. So it really leaves it open to the discretion of the entity to set the policy.
We are hopeful as these policies are discussed and implemented at the local level that there will be some interaction with everyone who is going to be involved in the application of these policies, and that there'll be some consistency in the application. But we could, in fact, conceive of a situation in which a sheriff is going out to some group or a chief is going out to some group. In that case, they're most likely to be representing their city or their jurisdiction. And again, we have no problem with that. But I think there is countless numbers of different situations that are going to have to be thought through. And we did not want to pass a state statute that says everybody can or everybody can't. It's open to the jurisdictions to make the determination.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to ask a question of Representative Garrett, please.
Okay.
Is he allowed to do that?
If I say so.
If he says so, he gets
me off the stand. I think it's a good idea.
Did he answer your question? Say it.
I think so.
Yeah.
As I understand it, we are hearing that departments can implement whatever they want in the way of policy.
He just want a policy.
And I guess the hope is that the process of having to do a policy will require some rationality.
That is correct.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Representative Cameron.
Thank you, and thanks for the clarification. That being the case, how do we get here? What's today? And I'm thinking I have firemen come in and visit me in the Capitol. They have some sort of uniform on. Different people with different uniforms. What's the policy today, and how is that set, and how is that enacted if what we just heard is... If we pass this, then there'll be all kinds of different policies all over the board.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, let me first clarify that when a firefighter comes and sees you, they're not in uniform. They're in a union blue T-shirt that has their union logo on it. That's not a uniform. Although that's readily identifiable as a firefighter, they don't show up in a turnout with a helmet and so forth. So that's the one clarification that makes that very, very different. What does, however, make this different is that we have a number of jurisdictions that have absolutely no policy, so they do the stuff on the fly. And over a period of time, their application is inconsistent. And we would like that application to be consistent so that everybody knows what the policy is, everybody knows when you can and when you can't.
Thank you.
Sure. Just, Brian, a lot of times we hire part-time people like state police used to have cadets in the summer, and then you have recruits that are in a probationary period. They're not full-time hired and got through their probation period. Would you have any objection to the policy for them that is different than the guy who's between the chief of police or in between there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, I guess short answer was no. Also understanding, however, the secondary answer is those folks are likely not members of an association, so they wouldn't have an opportunity to show up and being represented as a part of an association that may, in fact, come to the Capitol building. But the answer to your question is each jurisdiction will be able to make up their own policy, and if it chooses to exclude those people that are part-time or cadets or whatever, so be it. We have no problem with that.
And I have just one more. No, that's okay. Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
We should have got into what retirees can do.
Hopefully retire.
Hopefully, yeah.
Mr. Adams, Mr. Winkles, and Mr. Powell.
Chair Barker, committee, for the record, I'm Mark Adams. I'm the chief of police for the city of Kaiser, Oregon, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Association of Police. Police Police agencies already adopt uniform policies that fit the community they serve. These policies are designed to protect the integrity of the uniform and the profession. House Bill 2400 asks the legislature to require a policy that police departments already have and prescribe the applicability of the policy despite the differing roles and responsibilities of department leaders and the line personnel. Local jurisdictions should be allowed to develop policies on topics that meet the needs of the agency and the community. The role of a law enforcement management and line officers are different. House Bill 2400 appears to require that police agencies adopt off-duty uniform policies that with the intent of applying them to police chiefs and sheriffs, despite the fact that the law enforcement management is responsible for the leadership of the department, for developing and maintaining public support for the mission of the police department, and for representing the agency in a wide range of forums. Performing the duties of a law enforcement leader often requires the use of the uniform. The uniform is an important symbol of the office that requires appropriate use. Mandating that the same policy which applies to a line employee also applies to management, including the agency's head, fails to adequately consider the differences in these roles. This is a big one, I think. Because they are salaried and because they are ultimately held responsible for the actions of the police department and the safety of the community they serve, police chiefs and sheriffs are on duty 24/7, 365 days a year. It is difficult to understand the purpose of this legislation and what it's attempting to accomplish. Federal law, federally based overtime rules, are substantially different for line level and management employees of a police agency. For example, federal law requires that the line officers at any event be paid while performing their duties and while in uniform. This doesn't apply to police chiefs and sheriffs, who are often required to represent the department in uniform without additional pay. The Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police urge you to vote no on House Bill 2400.
Okay, Chief, with the testimony, I'm sure you heard Mr. Glashmidt, he was saying you can set whatever policy you want, they just want a policy, and you say you already have one. How would this law interfere with that?
It would interfere as much as why is it needed? Why make a law when there's already every police department I'm aware of has policies and limits when that uniform can be worn? And it's never been, I never thought about limiting as far as testimony, as far as other kinds of things that can get you in trouble.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Powell. Sorry, anybody else have a question? The Chief. Yeah, Representative Stigler.
Just real quickly, I mean, you're not absolutely certain that every police agency in this state has a policy. Or are you?
I mean, Representative, I can't think of one that wouldn't.
One that wouldn't is maybe different than do they or don't they. I mean.
No, I couldn't say without absolute certainty that every agency does. But.
Thank you. Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But you would also agree that even if every department today had a policy, they're not required to, so tomorrow they could abandon them.
Chair Barker, I guess that would be true.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Given the line of questioning that Representative Garrett opened up, this might actually be a situation where legislative intent might end up mattering. And I just want to sort of speak to the record. What I'm hearing from some of the folks, at least, on the panel, is that if this ends up being in a yes vote, it isn't necessarily a yes vote suggesting that there should be different policies that are set forth now. Right, but instead that there just be some policy in existence which could include fully discretionary policies as I gather are the policies right now. And if that isn't the case, then either I would want a more clear manifestation of committee intent or would want a bill that more clearly manifested our intent.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John Powell representing the sheriffs for action, which are your 36 county sheriffs. Mr. Chairman and members, I was here today primarily to find out what the intent of the bill is, and I would gladly give up the sheriff's day at the Capitol if that would make everybody here happy and we could compromise with that. I'd be glad to give up that day, and I think about 34 of the 36 sheriffs would be glad to give it up. I think the previous testimony has spoken. I'm not aware of a police agency and that does not have a policy on the use of the uniform. You almost have to have such a policy. And I would make one request if the bill goes forward, and that is on line 4, where it references the sheriff's department, that should just say office. So it would read each county sheriff's office, I think, to be true to statutory framework. There is a statute, and I apologize for not having reviewed it this morning, but it's ORS 206-355 for your staff's purpose that deals, I think, with the sheriff's uniform. Thank you.
I'll ask you the same thing. Hearing the testimony, if they have a policy, this just says they have to have a policy. Where would this law, should we pass it, run afoul of that?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know that this law changes anything.
This says that there would, I mean, as I read it, this says that everybody will have a policy, and the testimony from you is we do, and so would this matter if you had it or not?
Mr. Chairman, that's why I was here today, to find out what the intent is. It doesn't appear to change the practice.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Walsh.
For the record, Scott Winkles, representing the League of Oregon Cities. League of Oregon Cities' concerns with this bill are much, perhaps, more philosophical than my colleagues to the left. League of Oregon Cities believes very strongly that local decision-making authorities are best done at the local level. Cities are governed by elected city councils. We hire our city managers. We hire our police department, our police chiefs. I would respectfully submit to this committee that these folks are perfectly capable of coming up with a uniform with governing where their uniform is displayed and how. This is a decision. I don't know that we could articulate what the compelling state interest is in dictating to a city that they adopt a uniform policy. But again, this is clearly something from our perspective that would be best handled at the local level with conversations with our local bargaining units.
An example I recall several years ago, Portland wanted to have a street light. They had a bond for streetlights, for more streetlights. So they took an officer and they said, okay, this is a political ad, but you can do this because we want it. And they had him prayed out and, you know, say we need streetlights. So, but the police association couldn't run somebody out to make their point on an issue in uniform. And it just, although, I mean, but what the question is, I hear your question is, why would we have the law? And the other side's question is, why not have a law that just says there will be a standard policy so that everybody knows the rules of the game and the chief can set whatever policy he wants?
Mr. Chairman, I guess if one of my clients came to me with that question and whether or not it was permissible, I would steer them to the Secretary of State's manual on when public resources can and cannot be used in a political advertisement. I believe what you're describing, if it didn't then, I think it most certainly would now violate the state's policy on using public resources in a political campaign. So I would advise the city not to do such a thing for any campaign.
I mean, I think they just appeared in uniform. I don't think he was paid for that. I mean, it wasn't like overtime or something. He just
didn't
do that.
Mr. Chairman, I think the utilization of the uniform, which is a publicly owned resource, is where there would be a problem.
Okay, thank you. Further questions? Representative Stigler.
Yeah, if I can go back to Mr. Adams, because I believe you're the one that brought up the issue about the performing the federal law. My understanding, if I recall my years ago when I had a situation that went to the whole overtime issue, it's a conjunctive, is it not? It's that if they're wearing their uniform while performing their duties. And it's a,
yes.
In other words, it's not a situation where there's an automatic assumption that just because they're in uniform, they're performing their duties. Isn't that correct reading?
Chairman Barker, Representative, I guess I can only answer that by going by our policy. They can't, you know, if they're wearing their uniform, they can only wear it when they're performing duty, so therefore they'd be working and they have to pay them.
Well, if a follow-up, Mr. Chair.
A follow-up, please.
And I understand that that's your policy, but I didn't want anybody leaving here thinking that there was a federal law which states that if somebody is in uniform, they're automatically assumed to be performing their duties and therefore subject to overtime pay. That's
I'm
not how it
correct.
Reads.
I misunderstood. Yes, okay. I'm not aware of any federal law that says
just
that.
Want to be clear on that.
It does get tricky sometimes.
Yeah.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, this bill is technically ready to work today. I think Mr. Powell made an important point about the sheriff's department, should say sheriff's office, and so we will not work the bill today.
Yep.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2400 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2401.
House Bill 2401 expands the definition of assault in the third degree to include an assault with a dangerous substance on a public safety officer. This has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. We do not yet have a fiscal on this, so it's not ready to be worked today.
Okay, thank you. Okay, why don't you go ahead first, then?
For the record, Brian DeLeishman. I'm here representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations. With me also to testify is Jeff Leedy, President of the Oregon State Police Officers Association, the state troopers. I represent both. But what's being passed out to you today is my testimony on behalf of the Oregon Council of Police Associations. I will attempt to be as brief as I can. I've had conversations with most of you individually about this bill. And I want to reinforce a couple of particular points of feedback. In discussion with committee members, many of them focused in on just the issue of spitting. And I want to focus on a much broader problem here. It's really a health-related problem. So if you will allow me, and with the permission of the chair, I also have attached some emails from some public safety officers who have had these types of exposure. I would like to read a couple of brief excerpts from that. I'm not going to read all the letters. I understand you can read. I have, however, because I know that you have a lot to read, highlighted a couple of points that I would like to cover. So let me go through this. Several sessions ago, the Oregon legislature established what us in the business affectionately call the sliming bill. The sliming bill originally was for the purposes of controlling behavior in correctional facilities that had gotten out of hand. Because of mandatory minimum sentencing, a number of the correctional inmates felt that they could act up, they could expose employees of correctional facilities to bodily fluids with immunity because they couldn't get off for good time. Therefore, they might as well act up. So there really was no problem. That bill ultimately did pass a number of sessions ago and has since then been expanded to include some other employees of correctional facilities, not just corrections officers, but also volunteers or contractors in those types of facilities. Let me tell you that the passage of that bill took care of the problem. There was one or two prosecutions under that, and the behavior stopped immediately. It is no longer a problem. That is what we're hoping for in expansion of that bill to line staff, public safety officers, including police officers, firefighters, parole and probation officers, and others that work outside of a correctional facility. Let me focus again on this bill is not simply about spitting on an officer. It's about the health and safety of the public safety officers. And it involves much more than spitting. It involves blood, feces, urine, as well as spit. When an officer has one of these exposures, they must undergo tests to see if they have had exposure first from someone who has a disease that could be transmitted. Second, the officer must, until they're given the all is fine, that the person doesn't have the disease, must refrain from a number of things like kissing their spouse and children, unprotected sex with their spouse, any other behavior that may transmit the possible disease to other family or to the public, key point, In the meantime, the officer must go on a prophylactic combination of medications that in many cases makes the officer sick, and I emphasize very sick. These medications are not just taking a pill, try and hope for the best. These officers get sick, many times missing work, workers' comp claims. There's costs associated with this behavior. If after the testing the exposure proves to be from someone who has a disease like HIV, AIDS, Hep C, or tuberculosis, as an example, the officer must continue on the meds, and in some cases as long as 6 months or more. I have at least one case that was relayed to me in the last day. I got, as I indicated, seven emails just in this bill yesterday. An officer that was on medication for multiple years because he did in fact have an exposure to Hep C and got Hep C. And the person who exposed him knew he had Hep C and intentionally exposed that officer to Hep C through blood. The folks that officers most often relay the story that they come in contact with are drug users. Obviously, you've heard estimates of the population in correctional facilities in Oregon of who has hepatitis C. I've heard the numbers. I think, quite frankly, I'll be extremely straight. I think the Department of Corrections doesn't want to know, don't ask, don't tell, how many of our folks actually have hepatitis C behind locked doors. But I've heard of numbers in the lower end of 50% of those folks that are incarcerated, and I've heard as high as two-thirds of those people have hepatitis. These are the kinds of people that my officers and public safety officers are being exposed to on a daily basis. So this issue is not just about spitting. I want to share some communications that I received, and again, with the chairman's indulgence, I've attached four. I've received three more. I'm not going to go through, but let me just touch base on a couple of them. First is an officer, James Nett, out of Portland. I won't read the whole thing, but he encountered a individual who was high on meth, was tearing down a fence, obviously nails involved, so forth. That individual was bleeding from a number of places. He was bleeding from the hands, face, mouth. When he was searched prior to being put in the patrol car, he was able to roll enough to spit blood into the officer's face. The next piece, obviously, is the officer has to notify their employment setting, their health officials, the individual doctor. We were able to, a number of sessions ago, get an expedited process for a blood draw so that the officer would know whether they've had the exposure or not. Prior to that, sometimes it took several months to be able to get even a blood draw to know whether or not somebody, in fact, had a disease that you were exposed to. Now it takes usually less than 7 days. So they go through the process with the health officer, nurse, or doctor. I think the real poignant story, though, is the next paragraph. This officer says, I've been a police officer for 13 years and been involved in various kinds of situations. I've been hit by civilians as I drove my patrol car. I've been injured while chasing and taking down burglary suspects. I have been shot at and have shot and killed someone in the line of duty. I've had to call my wife and wake her, telling her that I was okay, but that I would be late because of the shooting. In all those events and many others, the worst thing I've ever had to share with my wife was the blood exposure from a known drug using suspect. The waiting and the follow, the three follow-up blood draws were constantly hanging over us. I'll drop down to one sentence in the final paragraph. I've had to live with the constant worry for a year. Had my wife pull back from me when I touched her. That's the kind of thing we're really dealing with here. We're dealing with the health of the officer. We're dealing with the health of their family. Let me just point out on the next page, an officer who in Gresham actually served in the state of California before moving to Gresham. That officer was involved, and he relays his situation of having exposure in California. He was surprised to find out that it wasn't already a felony in the state of assaulting a public safety officer. And I won't read his statement, but he also was exposed to a large amount of blood saliva in the face, in the eyes. We're not talking about here, and I want to make it really clear, we're not talking about an anti-war protester who doesn't like a police officer and spits on him. We're talking about hardened criminals who know that they've got some kind of disease or at least want to frighten the officer or have a psychological impact on an officer by saying, ha, 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 I have hepatitis C, and now you're going to get it, and they spit in their face. That's the kind of thing we're dealing with here. We understand that there potentially is a physical to this because there'd be additional prosecutions and possibly incarcerations. However, as we're working through that physical, and I'm more than willing to work in ways and means with that physical, I think there's cost savings here. You have time off. You have lost time. You have workers' comp costs. You have a variety of costs that are avoided if we can stop this bad behavior. And with that, I'll let Trooper Lee tell you his story.
Mr. Chair, if I may,
yeah.
Quick question.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. DeLashmith. Does it matter what they're protesting? If they spit in an officer's face?
Chair Barker, Representative Cameron, no. But, you know, in discussing this with people, I think the reason why I bring that particular case up is immediately what comes to everybody's mind is someone who's protesting a war or protesting something. And that's not the kinds of cases that we're really talking about here. Also keep in mind, although that in fact is an exposure, but
absolutely.
Also keep in mind that the DA has the ability to decide which cases they're going to take forward. And I would venture to say with limited resources, a DA is not going to take a case forward in which they don't believe that, in fact, that officer was exposed to something dangerous and, it, in fact, it was a threat to their health and safety.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair Barker, Vice Chair Stigler, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Leedy, and if I'm not speaking loud enough, raise your hand. I just got some hearing aids, and so I'm trying to get used to them here. I've been a trooper for 23 years, been married for 25. Over my 23-year career, I've been exposed to tuberculosis, hepatitis A and C, HIV, the flu, the cold, and anything else I can get from somebody else. In one memorable incident about 10 years ago, I effected an arrest of a young man in a stolen car, and we went hand-to-hand, and he was bleeding from a head wound. And while we were fighting, he would constantly spit blood and saliva on me, and I didn't realize the gravity of it all until I went home. It was about 3 a.m. I still had my uniform on, and I was covered in blood. My wife woke up to see me, and of course, you can imagine the shock. The tough part was that the next day when I talked to her, I had to tell her we both had to get tested. It was a long year. She told me she understood the risks that I had to take as a police officer, and I undertake those risks on a regular basis willingly. I just didn't know I had to risk her health and the health of my kids while I was doing it myself. When that happens to you, it's a long, long time waiting for results, and it's unknown. And quite frankly, I was more worried about hepatitis than I was anything else, because that's a very common disease that we encounter. That's about all I have. I just want to give you a personal glimpse of that. If anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
With regard to hepatitis C, there is some question about, you know, where it comes from. And we had testing in Portland and found a certain number of people had it, and we tracked it back to exposures. But is it not true that that could lay dormant for 25 years?
That's the way I understand it. I've actually had the series of vaccinations. The first two times it didn't take.
So it is running. Okay, Representative Stigler.
Mr. DeLashmond, I was just going to ask. As I read this proposal, it adds public safety officer to a current I mean, it currently covers staff members and goes on to define, and these substances, it doesn't modify what's considered a dangerous substance. Is that right?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Stigler, that is correct. This is just an expansion of a current statute to cover more folks.
And maybe you can enlighten me as to why public safety officers were not included in the previous iteration when, quote-unquote, staff members were put in there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Stigler, actually I have a couple answers. One is when the bill originally passed, they believed that there would be a large fiscal just in the correctional setting. And so during that time period, they passed that bill. It actually took us two sessions to pass that bill. The fiscal panned out to not be as much as it was, and it took care of the behavior. The second part of the question or answer is that I think none of us were probably as keen on the types of exposures that line staff were coming under and continue to come under with the additional diseases that are out there, not just Hep C, HIV, and AIDS, but MRSA now, right, and a variety of other exposures that they get. And it wasn't until I think perhaps a couple of our member associations brought it to our attention and said, listen, by the way, this has been on the books for correctional folks. Take care of the problem. We're beginning to see the same kinds of intentional exposures. And so is there any way we can expand this to cover our health as well?
And because of the fiscal, I assume we're not working it today.
That's correct.
And I might want leave to work with you on an amendment, and I'd want to work through about it. Let me say a little bit about what Representative Stigler said. I think there is a significant difference in the expectation of freedom of somebody incarcerated and somebody out in the world. Right, and I think it is not inappropriate for us to at least analyze whether we want the same standard applied to someone currently in custody versus somebody who is in the process of getting into custody or not, depending on whether or not they're guilty. So that's the first thing I wanted to say in response to Representative Stigler's question. Obviously, you know, blood, feces, disease-borne saliva, et cetera, I have no problem with those things being subject to significant penalties. What's the current penalty? Is it harassment? What's the current penalty for disease-free saliva that is spit upon a police officer, which is also obviously inappropriate?
Representative Barker, or Chair Barker, Representative Smith, the current normal charge, is a harassment. And it is regardless of whether or not the individual knows that they're intentionally exposing somebody or not. The penalty being that low, in many cases, jurisdictions either won't pursue it, if it's related to obviously some other case in which they're being arrested for something much more severe, obviously that would be a very minor piece of the whole thing. But the one thing that we did find in the correctional setting was that when the penalty was elevated to a felony, everybody took it much more seriously.
Yep.
And I understand what you're talking about and the difference between correctional setting and behavior there that needs to be modified and street behavior. But at the same time, if we're having people on the street doing these types of behaviors, knowing that there's going to be no repercussions, we have concerns about that.
Mm-hmm.
We're willing to work with you on a suggestion that you may have. But at the same time, we want to modify the behavior. We want to protect our officers.
Yep.
That's what it comes down to. It's protection of the officers. And as some of the officers that pointed out to me, they said, listen, I know when I go out there, I may get shot at, I may get killed in an auto accident. But what I never really signed up for was getting Hep C or HIV. It never came up, and all of a sudden it's an issue for them. They take precautions. I mean, they glove up. They do everything they're supposed to do. But in search containing some of these folks that they deal with, you cannot protect yourself in all cases. Not everybody wears glasses. Maybe all of our officers should have spit-proof glasses and have a surgical mask anytime they take anybody into custody. They don't. We're trying to protect their health and safety in this bill.
Yeah. Follow up? Understand, and let me also say, I think there's also a significant difference between the correctional setting and you know, the street setting, in terms of our ability to transmit information about what standards of behavior are, right? I mean, like, whatever bill we pass through here, we might or might not get great penetration in the zeitgeist of the community, right? Whereas in a lockdown setting, we can relatively quickly communicate what the standards of behavior are and what the punishments are. So I think all of us share, I mean, 10 votes out of 10 and everybody in the room shares the interest of, you know, eliminating the behavior, reducing the behavior of people showing disrespect, physical disrespect, and putting the officers in danger. I think the question is, you know, what's the best way to do that, but is disease-free saliva in the same category as disease-filled saliva, and can we ever know, and is that in the same category as blood? So I just want to say for the record, and we can talk about after since we're not working today, is to see if there's a possibility of, yeah, maybe we elevate the punishment for just spitting, even if it's clean spit, okay, so maybe, you know, adding additional deterrence to that, and making sure there's a blood test taken any time somebody spits on an officer. And if 25 years from now, at any point, that is, you know, it turns out that that was infected saliva, whether or not it's transmitted, that's a high crime, right? But if it really is, using your example, what did you say, the anti-war protester, it might be an anti-abortion protester, might be any kind of protester, who just says, hey, you, and does something stupid, you know, is that the same thing as wiping blood on? And I think as we're thinking about relative levels, that's a fair conversation for us to have, and I'll end with that.
Thank you.
As somebody who's been spit on before, I have a little different opinion, but that's my name. I remember when old people like Representative Krieger and I started, blood was clean and sex was dirty, but things have changed.
That's because you worked in Portland.
Yeah, I'm so glad.
Carwentels and Katie Saver.
You got out of that one.
Hey, Mr. Chair, I'm just really glad I was a recruit when you guys were guys.
We're a great school. Literally.
Yeah. Wow. Mr. Adams, do you want to come up too, Chief? I'm sorry. And just go ahead in any order you like. Just please identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Good afternoon. My name is Katie Suver. I'm a deputy district attorney in Marion County. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. I have prepared some written testimony in support of this bill. The District Attorneys Association does support this bill, and I would simply echo the comments that were made previously by the first two witnesses who testified. I do want to point out that under current law, we cannot charge a person with the crime of assault in the third degree if they spit on a paramedic or police officer, someone who's responding usually as a first responder to render aid, or in the circumstances where they're arresting an individual, if they get blood on them either purposefully or because of their own reckless conduct, some other type of bodily fluid gets on them. In fact, there is no crime under the current statutory scheme that specifically relates to this type of conduct with a police officer or paramedic or a firefighter. Typically, what DA's offices will do is they will analyze the facts of the situation and determine whether or not we can prove the crime of harassment. I would ask the committee members to keep in mind, however, that the crime of harassment requires that we prove that the person intended to harass or annoy the individual by subjecting that person to offensive physical conduct. Contact. Those are the elements of harassment, and there's a lot of different ways that we can charge harassment. That is the typical crime that we use for these circumstances. Keep in mind, that requires that we prove intent. Intent can be negated by such things as voluntary intoxication, intoxication due to methamphetamine use, intoxication due to alcohol, or some other types of circumstances. And I, as a prosecutor, tend to look at these cases as significantly more dangerous than some other situations because of the fact that typically this is behavior that is directed toward first responders. And let's keep in mind, this is not just police officers that we're talking about. We're talking talking about EMTs, we're talking about paramedics, we're talking about firefighters. These are the folks that respond when somebody calls 911. And a B misdemeanor with a maximum penalty of 180 days in jail, which is typically not a penalty that would be assessed for this type of crime, is simply not sufficient punishment for engaging in that behavior. So we do support the bill.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Scott Winkles representing the League of Oregon Cities. It's generally not my habit to, what we call in the lobby, me too a bill, but the League definitely would like to go on record as supporting this bill. We would regard the exposure, intentionally or recklessly exposing a public safety officer, be it police, fire, or medical, with a bodily substance that any reasonable person knows is has a potential to spread disease is an assault against not just that officer, but their colleagues, the public, their family as well, and believes it ought to be treated differently.
Thank you. Chief?
Chair of the Committee, Mark Adams, Chief of Police for the City of Kaiser, representing Oregon Association's Chiefs of Police, and we're here to testify in support of the passage of this bill. We care about our officers a lot, and I've been a police officer 28 years, and I remember when I used to just worry about getting wingworms or scabies. And then this today, it's a whole different ballgame out there. And there's a lot of bad people who are, in my opinion, don't have the guts to throw a punch at a police officer, but they're more than happy to spit in your face. And it's just as assaulted to me as it would be to hit me with your fist. And I think that's where it's important. I think the message would get out there real quick that this is not acceptable.
Chief in Portland, I can recall speaking with an assistant chief who said, an officer had been spit on, slapped somebody, and they disciplined the officer because they said that was such a gross reaction, to overreaction to that. So an officer, the public quickly learns these things, an officer, that you can spit on them, and that's all, you know, they can't really take a physical action at the time, or at least they're not supposed to. I mean, I think, do you think that has something to do with people being brave enough to come up and spit on you?
Mr. Chair, I do, and I have to tell you, it is probably the hardest restraint I've ever had to use on myself is not to just react, just as reaction, you know, slap somebody or something when they spit in your face. It's hard to stand there and take that because you don't know what just got in your face. You know.
Thank you. Representative Krieger.
Is it Katie? Why don't we protect the district attorney? He's with those people. He's in the courtroom. He's in proximity of these people. What about the judge? It seems to me that anyone in the public safety, judge, DA, the police officer, parole and probation, everybody ought to be covered.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, it's interesting that you mention that because prior to my coming over here to testify, before I walked a couple of blocks, one of my colleagues at the office said, why aren't we including DAs in this? And obviously, I think you make an excellent point, and that is that there are other people in the law enforcement community and certainly in the justice system that can be affected by this behavior. I will tell you that as I sit in a courtroom most days, there is always a deputy sheriff who is guarding a prisoner between me and the prisoner. They do an excellent job of making sure that the prisoner doesn't come close to me and that doesn't have the opportunity to do this. Now, somebody being determined enough to do it would still be able to, but I think this bill focusing on the first responders is the next best step. So while I don't disagree that there probably could be other people who could be included in this bill, I would first like to see that police officers, paramedics, firefighters get protected.
Yeah, Representative, if somebody spit on a judge, we'd see judicial discretion.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, you would. Interesting.
Okay, thank you, panel. Mr. Livingston?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, my name is Bob Livingston. I represent the Oregon State Firefighters Council. I also happen to be a firefighter. And just real briefly, I wanted to make a few points. First, thank Mr. DeLashmit and his folks for bringing this to your attention. It's something that is certainly appreciated and appreciate his leadership on that particular issue. One of the things that I think was not mentioned previously is that what we're talking about particularly, and I think you did talk about it briefly, is that some of these people really simply don't care who you are, whether you're a police officer, whether you're a firefighter, whether you're a paramedic. The fact of the matter is particularly in my personal experience, particularly those that are amped up on methamphetamines or drugs, you know, they may be very good people, but at the time that they're in one of their rages, you know, they do evil things. And one of the things that unfortunately we've learned over the last, probably even from the time that the three distinguished gentlemen that have been in this field before, one of the things that we're extremely cognizant about now is when you put these people into handcuffs or before you send them to the jail for booking and whatnot, it's pretty routine that they call for EMS to come and evaluate these people. And in many instances, you have to extremely be careful. And where I'm going with this is, unfortunately, we've learned a lot about positional asphyxiation. And because of that, that does put not only police officers and paramedics and firefighters at greater risk, because you have to put them in a certain position, and then to be able to care for them, you simply are at greater risk. And so something does need to be done about this. It is a concern. It's something that I've lived with personally, having been exposed to many of the same things that Mr. Lady has. It is disconcerting, and it's something that we're concerned with. But I'm also proud to say that being professional, just like I know that Mr. Leedy is and the fellow public safety officers, there's been no time, and I'm unique in the fact that I won't tell you where I work, but we do have at least five major correctional facilities within my jurisdiction that irrespective of whether it's been taking care of one of these individuals that you're called upon or the grandma down the street, they get the same level of care. You do what you need to do because you're professional in that. And while, yeah, it does come with the territory, there are people out there that want to do you harm, and it's something that I'm glad you're going to at least be able to address and try to move this forward, particularly in light of the tough economic times, and you're going to have a lot of difficult decisions to make. But appreciate your hearing this, and again, appreciate the leadership of Mr. DeLashmit bringing this forward.
I'd like to ask you, Ms. Ferguson, when one of your firefighters is diagnosed with hepatitis C, regardless of how they got it, does workers' comp cover that, or is that an uphill battle?
Chair Barker, it's a good question. The fact of the matter is it's an uphill battle. It's not a presumptive piece of legislation. You have to prove of where you contracted that.
And just without getting into medical records too much, when I served on the disability board with the City of Portland, which was a different system, the firefighters in Portland did a baseline testing, and there was several of them had hepatitis C that came through. A lot of it was not hostile contact, but just blood exposure, especially for the paramedics, where, and like I say, in the old days when we used to deal in a car wreck or whatever, you know, you'd get blood, airborne blood pathogens, but at that time, at least Portland was taking pretty good care of their officers and firefighters.
And I think, Mr. Chair, if I may, just real quick on that, I think for the most part, most employers attempt to do that. That's one of the things that we've worked with, particularly with the Oregon Fire Chiefs, to encourage pre-screening for hepatitis C and those things. It wouldn't preclude somebody from being a public safety officer, but sure is nice to know, especially these diseases that have latency, to prove that. And one other thing that's a little bit off subject, Mr. Chair, if I may, one of the reasons why we think this is an important topic and an issue, and we're still doing research on this, but the federal Ryan White Act is a law that allows for public safety officers to know when they've been in contact with certain types of diseases, Hep C, HIV, those kind of things. And unfortunately, I'm still trying to research, they eliminated that provision on that right to know for local public safety officers. And so this is a good subject matter and something that, you know, we're still trying to do research, but if we may need to address that simply because right now it's only at the kindness and that good working relationship that public safety officers have with the local hospitals on whether we would even have the right to know whether we've been exposed to these things or not. So with that, Mr. Chair, appreciate your time, and thanks for letting me come speak to you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Livingston. Ms. Meyer.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. I am Gail Meyer, legislative representative on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I would like to, at the outset, offer to be at the table if there is an effort on behalf of the committee to ask for any revisions. I can fully appreciate and understand what I think the conduct is that's attempting to be addressed here, and I think that the bill, as currently framed, may not capture clearly all that intent, but I would like to just simply offer my assistance if there's an effort at rewriting any of it. Getting back to the example of the anti-war protester who might spit at an officer, as currently framed, this statute would pick that up, and it would create a felony, and it would mandate a prison sentence. So if you look at subsection I, line 10, knowing that the other person is a public safety officer or a staff member intentionally or knowingly propels a dangerous substance at the public safety officer acting in the course of the its official duties. So that would incorporate spitting in an anti-war protest. And quite frankly, the bill as framed doesn't even require that the propelling be aimed intentionally at the face or some opening that would allow for the dangerous substance to get into the bloodstream. I mean, it would also, by language, allow for a spitting at one's boots. So I think that as currently framed, it's broader than what I've understood the testimony is intending to accomplish and address. If I might jump off of some of comments made by Representative Smith, I do think that there is a difference between the conduct that does occur in a correctional facility versus this incident that might occur in the field. And again, that could relate to the level of penalty that is associated with that conduct. So in a correctional facility, you've got these crimes committing in the watchful presence of others who may be tempted to engage in copycat behavior, and there's a certain entertainment value behind it all. And in order to have a deterrent effect for punishment, you would need to have felony status associated with this, and you would need to mandate a prison imposition of a sentence. In the field, I question whether that deterrent effect would translate to an isolated incident of an individual who's being apprehended. I just don't know that the translation of the deterrent effect would be rather immediate in a custodial facility. I don't know that it would be all that likely to occur in an isolated instance of an arrest out there in the field. And to that extent, then, I question whether this needs to mandate a prison imposition of a sentence, because I don't know that they are really in all instances parallel. So I raise those issues for the committee and offer my assistance. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I just would point out that most felons don't go to prison in Oregon. I mean, there's a small number if you take a look at all those, but your points are well taken. I would appreciate if you would assist in taking a second look at this.
I'd appreciate it, yeah.
Okay. Representative
Wisniak. Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we're going to look at this bill, I would also recommend the Oregon Military Department be contacted and see if we want to put in there. In our recent storms in this December, we had National Guard was assisting police officers, and also police, the Guard could be called in for other public safety issues you might want to
put. Yeah, Representative Stigler.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I just actually have this more directed. If we're going to direct this out to do any kind of tweaking or reworking, I don't want to lose the essence of, I think, what's trying to be achieved here. And I guess I would ask that that be kept in focus in any kind of, if we water this down or wash this down to where it's not even coming close to addressing the problem that has been discussed here, then we're defeating the purpose.
Representative Cameron.
Mr. Chair, as I read the bill, what we're doing is bringing some other people into a statute that's already been there, already applied in law. So I'm concerned about reworking a whole statute policy versus are we just bringing in some people that we would apply this same statute to?
Well, I'd like to have a little work group just take a look at that and be sure we stay on so we don't have some unintended consequences. I appreciate your point there. And I don't know when it became okay to go to spit on people at any time, anybody. But Representative Stigler.
Follow up there, too. And I guess I understand the issue regarding the deterrent effect, but I don't think that's the crux of the focus here. I think it's acceptable behaviors versus unacceptable behaviors, and what are the consequences of those behaviors? And I guess I would submit that, you know, a person, and I understand the situation about the, you know, it may get to be dicey here when we're talking about the circumstances and situations where these things might occur, and whereas we're not maybe trying to capture the riot, but, you know, somebody in those situations who may have one of these diseases should, you know, I wouldn't want them being ruled out of the possibilities of inclusion under these circumstances if they're full well aware of what, you know, what disease they have and what the result is going to be if they spit in somebody's eye. So, I don't think we're talking about boots. But I understand. But I don't want us to lose the essence of what we're talking about here.
If I might comment, Chair Barker and Representative Siegler, members of the committee, I think I know what you're saying. And all the examples that were proffered by the proponents of the bill and are in the emails are really egregious behavior. It's also it's intentional behavior. Right. And I noticed that as framed, it picks up knowing and intentional, which can sound, you know, like a non-difference or very technical difference, but I think what we're trying to get at here is at least on the field, it could look differently in a custodial facility, but in the field, the concern is when this bodily substance gets into their face and into openings that could get into the bloodstream. And I think we do simply, it would be good to have some clarity, and I offer to be of assistance.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate that. Representative Smith.
Yeah, just for the record, I also just want to say for the record, absolutely we should cleave to the intent of the bill, and I think we should work to cover every egregious example that was offered by the proponents of the bill, every single one, and only try to even pay attention to the type of example they offered they weren't trying to go after. And beyond that, I mean, I think it would be a minor, any changes be a minor fix. My guess is we'll, after that will be a 10-0 support for the bill, or at least, you know, something to somebody.
It's 9-1.
I mean, Cameron's not going to support it regardless of what we do, but...
Thank you, Ms. Meredith. Thank you. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2401. Then we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2403.
House Bill 2403 authorizes forfeiture of a vehicle with a hidden compartment if the vehicle was used or intended to be used in a criminal offense. We do not have the fiscal back on this, and it's my understanding that there might be amendments as well.
Mike Dingman.
Whose amendments?
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Mike Dingaman. I'm a lieutenant with the Oregon State Police, and I oversee our drug enforcement section. What I wanted to have an opportunity to talk to you about today was what the purpose is behind 2403, and recognizing that we made an effort to get the language in the bill that would solve our problem, but as we've studied this, we've learned that, you know, maybe the language needs to be adjusted a little bit, so we are going to probably... But if I may, I thought I'd at least take the opportunity to explain to you, what the problem is that law enforcement's dealing with when we encounter these vehicles. What we know is that, and it's probably no secret to anybody here, is that, you know, there's a significant amount of drugs, currency, weapons, and other types of contraband that are being smuggled upon our highway system, both into Oregon, around Oregon, and through Oregon. And we run into these vehicles through our drug task force investigations. We also run into these vehicles just during our normal routine traffic stops where, you know, we'll uncover a significant quantity of drugs, for example. And what I'm talking about with a hidden compartment is what drug smugglers will do is take a vehicle and they will alter that vehicle. They'll cut holes in it. They'll put false floors in it. They'll adjust the gas tanks, the engine, take advantage of natural cavities in the vehicle, and turn them into a compartment to secrete the drugs, money, weapons, whatever the contraband is, so that they can move it from point A to point B undetected, and especially they're expecting to get stopped by law enforcement, and they don't want us to find it. But from on occasion, we do find it. So the issue we come in is when we seize that vehicle, and we normally would seize it as evidence, and it may or may not be subject to forfeiture, the problem we have is what do we do with them once we got them? The issue is that we don't want to be in a position where we're releasing these vehicles back out into public circulation, one, where it can be used again by the trafficker, but more importantly, by what's going to happen is that trafficker more than likely is going to dump that vehicle, and a third party innocent owner is going to end up with it. They're not going to know there's a trap. We call them traps. They're not going to know that there's a trap in the vehicle that may have compromised the safety features of that vehicle. And the compartments that we're talking about deal from fairly minor compartments that are easy to deal with to some pretty sophisticated compartments where, I mean, you know, they'll put a complete false floor to increase a cavity, so that it's a major alteration to the vehicle. What happens with us is when we're trying to get rid of it is who's going to pay to either permanently disable that trap or remove it from the vehicle so that it can either be sold or released back. You know, they say there's an interest holder on the vehicle, maybe a bank. It's a vehicle law enforcement didn't want, probably wouldn't have seized had it not been for the fact that it had a trap in it, and you have a third party or a bank that has a $10,000 or $13,000 note on it. What are we going to do with it? So we're having some discussions about, you know, we can, in certain situations, we can disable, remove that compartment, we can sell it. It would just go through the normal forfeiture process like we already have in statute. But what we would want to ensure is that law enforcement isn't having the burden of bearing those costs associated with doing that. So if we did have to invest money to repair a trap, that would come off the top for. And then also be able to deal with a scenario. If we were to keep it, how would those costs be distributed? And if we were to return it back to the owner or a bank or whoever this other interest holder might be, how do we do that so that law enforcement doesn't have to bear the costs? So in essence, that's the bottom line. We've been just some brief discussions with the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association and ACLU and been kind of talking about what we might be able to do to come up with some different language. This bill is tending to deal with them as contraband, and we were talking about the side effects of doing that, and by treating them as contraband, it may not give us the ability to maybe deal with some of the scenarios that we want to deal with. So we had some other ideas on how we might do that. The other thing is I think we need to add some additional language to what we mean by a hidden compartment so that you know, we all have the discussion, we all understand what we're talking about, but then when the practitioners get a hold of the statute, we want to make sure it's clear about what we're talking to. We're talking about aftermarket type alterations that are being made to a vehicle.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually had a quick question for you, actually, too. So now that you've spoken on this, my understanding, from reading it, it looked as though you were trying, the intent was to create civil forfeiture, criminal forfeiture, and this third manner in which a vehicle could be forfeited on the motion of the court. What I'm taking from listening to you is that what you're looking for is a mechanism by which you can dismantle these compartments and things like that and then put the vehicle back into the normal stream, whether it's through forfeiture, whether it's repossessed by the bank, whatever. Am I correct now?
Chair Barker, counsel, correct. When we initially started this, when we threw out the concept initially, we thought that, and there are some states that do have some statutes that deal with this, but you know, we've already got a statute that deals with weapons, for example, on how they're once you get a judgment, they're automatically forfeited. It doesn't apply to the forfeiture distributions, and we thought, well, with these vehicles, can't we just apply the same logic when doing that? So when this bill was drafted initially, that was kind of the line of thinking that was used, but then when we started talking to the attorneys and everybody started looking at it, we've recognized that, you know, there's some scenarios that have come up that maybe that won't address fully, so we need to take another look at it.
One question?
Sure.
Okay, I think you've answered this question, but just to follow up, then in the instances where, you know, they find the, you know, half pound of meth or heroin in the vents or in the ducts inside the dash compartment, would that then, in as I'm listening to you, it sounds like that you would still intend for that to go through the criminal forfeiture as fruits or instrumentalities, and we're talking here about the center console where they've added in the switch that allows them to now hide or secrete something in the bottom, and it's aftermarket, am I understanding?
Chair Barker, Council, yes. What we're trying to do is distinguish these vehicles. We're not talking about those times when they're using the natural voids of the vehicle solely. They've just taken a pop the panel, they put the drugs in there and put the panel back on. We're actually talking about, you know, there's been some kind of an alteration, an addition, they've cut a hole, that kind of thing. Now, what we were talking about is that we may be able to deal with this scenario in the criminal and civil forfeiture statutes where this bill initially wasn't so much in that process. So when we were having the discussions, we were talking about in terms of process and expediency and is that a vehicle that we can might maybe make some minor adjustments to that would fit these different scenarios. And the one that's come up that if it wasn't for this one, it would probably be a very easy thing, but is that what do we do when we have a third-party owner? We don't want the vehicle. We want to return it, but we don't want to return it with a compartment in it. You know, we want that compartment taken out.
Representative Krieger.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Lieutenant, I understand where you're going and why you're trying to go. They've been around that a little bit, but have some concerns, as I imagine you've come up, on line 9, intended to be used. I may put a compartment in my vehicle, which is when you stop me or you stop my son, you search the rig, you find this compartment, there's nothing in it. So I probably have that compartment to put my concealed weapon in. Maybe I want to put a very expensive camera or on a trip, some jewelry belonging to my wife, and it may even be a lockable compartment. How are you going to differentiate intent unless at the time you stop it, there's either drugs in it or there's residue in it or something like that, and then you've got to have PC to even check on that? I understand what you're trying to do, but I think it's not quite as simple as what this bill entails in it.
Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, you're correct in that, when an officer encounters these vehicles, they're going to have probable cause to believe that that vehicle with that compartment is being used as an instrumentality to commit a crime or that in some way it's proceeds. So, those elements of that crime would have to be present. If those weren't present, even though you had the compartment, if you couldn't prove that, then it wouldn't be subject to seizure in that scenario. And in understanding that, although it's very rare that we've ever encountered those scenarios, but that there are people that will use secret compartments in vehicles to just simply transport valuables. But by having the piece in there that law enforcement's going to have to show that that vehicle with that trap was being used to commission a crime. And if they can't do that, then it wouldn't be subject to seizure to begin with.
Representative Shield.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Just one more. A little follow-up. Representative Olson in 2005 worked on a forfeiture bill because of an appeals court decision. And having been around this, there were instances where law enforcement was really using some of this forfeiture stuff to kind of fund certain projects and agencies, and it all came back to bite them in the butt. And I would just caution everybody, we want to support you. We want you to do what you need to do. But at the same time, don't violate the trust that we give you in some of these laws by exceeding it. So your training that you're going to have to give those people that work with that, not to use the law as an excuse to get a forfeiture for the purpose of financial gain to an agency so they can fund their narcotics team. After we got that passed, Representative Olson, that was one of his first big bills, and a lot of work went into it, and it didn't pass unanimously either. I went back and talked to every one of my chiefs of police and our local narcotics group there in Coos Bay, South Coast, and cautioned them, don't do that, because then the trust that we've put in you to use your good judgment is not going to be well placed, and it's going to make it harder for you in the future.
Representative Shields.
I just wanted to clarify what you were suggesting is that you would define what hidden compartment actually meant and put it in statute in the amendment.
Chair Barker, Representative Shields, yes, if you look on page 2, there on line 2, there was an effort to define what a hidden compartment is. And this was based upon language that we had seen in about, I think there were three states that we were looking at that had similar language to that. But what when we're looking at it, we still think that we need to make it clear that, you know, we're not talking about, you know, you may have a manufacturer that maybe even build a hidden compartment into a vehicle, you know, maybe an upper-end vehicle for the purpose of a person wanting to be able to conceal their valuables, and that make sure that, you know, that's not the kind of compartment we're talking about. We're talking about something that's been done aftermarket to the vehicle for the purpose of, you know, concealing contraband and moving it from point A to point B.
Okay. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have some confusion regarding this. It seems to me when I read this bill that the purpose of the bill is actually to create essentially a new procedure by which vehicles with hidden compartments can be forfeited, as opposed to the ORS 131 or ORS 475A. However, as I hear this testimony today, it sounds as though your intent is quite different. It is actually basically to facilitate, just in general, to clarify that vehicles with hidden compartments used for illicit purposes should be forfeited. But is that not already the law? I'm thinking specifically of ORS 131-558 and 475A-020, particularly subsection 3 of each. They're powerful statutes. Aren't these vehicles already subject to forfeiture?
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, yes, they are subject to forfeiture, but the question becomes, once they've been forfeited, what do we do with them? Do we destroy them? Do we keep them for training? Do we sell, you know, auction them off to get the proceeds and then distribute through, you know, the forfeiture distribution formulas? And the issue we have is, in order for us to keep that vehicle out of circulation and forfeit it, and that we, law enforcement, would have to bear the cost of either pay. If we keep it, we got to pay out the, you know, if it's criminal forfeiture, it's 60% of those proceeds or value of that vehicle is what we have to pay in order to keep that vehicle. And when civil comes online, it's going to be a little bit less. But we should have the ability to make sure that, if, let's say we want to sell the vehicle, and we're not going to sell it unless we take that compartment out or we permanently disable it and things are in a manner that we haven't compromised the safety features of the vehicle. Law enforcement wants to ensure that we're able to deduct those costs off the top prior to that distribution, you know, that formula kicking in. The other scenario is, well, what about, you know, we don't have any other interest holders in the vehicle. It's a very sophisticated compartment where we, you know, the whole floor has been raised up, and it's cost prohibitive to repair it. Then we want to destroy it. So then the question becomes, well, if you forfeit the vehicle, in order for us to keep it and destroy it, you know, how do those forfeiture distributions play? Because normally the way it works with law enforcement, if we want to keep a vehicle and we don't go sell it, we got to pay out those distributions. And so we end up upside down. We end up eating a pretty significant amount of money to do that.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
So just to clarify, and perhaps I actually, now occurs to me that I'm echoing counsel's original question. It is not your intent to create a new forfeiture procedure?
No, it's not.
And I'd like to just say, to make clear kind of the intent as well, along Representative Krieger's line, should I have a concealed compartment in my car to put my gun in, and one day Chip Shields says, gee, can I borrow your car? I need to go someplace. And I say, sure, and he gets stopped. I mean,
yeah. With your bag of weed in the glove.
Yeah, but he gets his weed out of the window before you stop him. But so anyway, if the car stops and there's my gun in it, and he has no reason to have the gun in there, we don't want to see cars like that being seized either, or attempt to seize, saying that there's a crime and that he had no permit and he's concealing a weapon.
Chair Barker, that's correct. Yeah, those aren't the scenarios we're talking about. And again, we would not be able to seize the vehicle unless we had probable cause to believe that it was evidence of a crime or it was an instrumentality or a proceed associated with one of the qualifying crimes if we were going to apply the forfeiture statute. So in that case, if the criminal conduct wasn't there, then nothing would happen.
I drove Representative Olson's truck today, and I have no idea what was in that, so I just took a chance. Counsel.
You may have already explored this possibility, but The forfeiture statute in itself is being kind of reintroduced in the Senate right now. Basically, what they're doing is they're looking at, there have been so many changes to the law, and with, as you noted, some of the Supreme Court cases have gone back and forth, and they kind of have to reinstitute the whole thing all over again. And I'm wondering if, in the process of talking to the other parties involved in this, you would consider perhaps that this should perhaps be an amendment to that bill, because it sounds like you're on point in some way. You're just trying to develop a procedure so police departments don't get stuck with a bill for removing this kind of thing from a vehicle that's already been forfeited and it's under the current forfeiture laws. Am I right?
Chair Barker and Council, we had that discussion, and our concern was is that the preference was to keep it separate from the forfeiture bill because a lot of work had already gone into the forfeiture bill that's in committee now. To implement ballot measure 53 and the technical changes and making it more user-friendly for practitioners. And what we didn't want to do was then introduce another amendment. I mean, I don't know that we'll come to a resolution on this. I'm hopeful that, you know, everybody will be able to sit down, we'll be able to come up with some language that meets everybody's concerns. But if we try to make an amendment to that bill and this muddies the water, we'd rather not have that happen. We would like to see that other bill move through. Since so much work's already been put into that one.
Okay, thank you very much, Lieutenant, for the questions. Thank you. Okay. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2403 and open a work session on 2311. Go ahead and tell us about that one.
I'm going to refresh it.
Yeah.
House Bill 2311, this was the bill kind of clarified that with respect to restraining orders and stalking orders that legal service of process would not be considered a violation. And I can tell you, if you'll just give me a moment, looks like David Garrett spoke on this, and I don't believe there was any opposition at the time. Or it might be Gannett, I'm sorry.
This was to allow process serving under court direction, it wasn't harassment.
Okay. Under the rules of civil procedure. So there's no fiscal, there's no revenue impact.
Yes.
I have two different. Is this the new? This is the one says HB 2311A, and then the other one says HB 2311.
That was my mistake at the beginning. I thought I had to put letters next to things.
Oh, okay. So this is the one we pay attention to, the second, the one without a letter.
Okay.
Any further discussion? I accept a motion to move this to the floor with a due pass. Representative Wisnant moves House Bill 2311 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, after we vote, if we have a unanimous vote, I'm going to move this to the consent calendar. Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Motion carries. Is there any objection to putting that on the consent calendar? Hearing none, so ordered. We have three more committee bills to introduce today. One has the title relating to driving while under the influence of intoxicants. Another is relating to courts and providing for revenue raising that requires approval by 3/5 majority. And the other one's relating to court filings. Adopting these does not mean you have any indication as whether you support or don't support the bill, and you're obviously free to do whatever you want once we get them. I'll accept a motion to adopt LC 2872.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Stegler moves we adopt LC 2872. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. I'll accept a motion to adopt LC 3007.
I'll move.
Representative Stegler moves we adopt LC 3007. Hearing no objection, so ordered. And I'll accept a motion to adopt LC 3069.
So moved.
Okay. Representative Wisnant moves we adopt LC 3069. Is the committee bill hearing no objection? So ordered. No further business today.
Mr. Chair, yeah, one thing on your on the spitting bill, you've got some people going to meet. Might be well to have somebody on that from this committee to kind of make sure things are inclusive.
Yes, Lieutenant Olson.
And Representative Smith.
And Representative Smith.
Good.
What was it that he asked?
He said he's going to pick up the bar tab. And I said, Lieutenant Olson.
Really?
You snooze, you lose.
Make sure it's 9-1.